Hello and welcome to the Head Stuff podcast. This is the Kevin Barry episode. There's Connor.
Hello, Alan.
How are you doing? I was very, very excited about this episode.
Yeah, you were very excited.
Yeah.
When I came in here earlier, you were like a giddy child.
Yes, yeah. I don't normally get too nervous, but a little bit. I mean, Kevin Barry he's definitely one of the best writers in Ireland and therefore the world. He's an incredible writer. He's got 4 books since 2007, and we talk about them in this episode. There Are Little Kingdoms, City of Bohan, Dark Lies the Island, and Beetlebone. And every one of them is just brilliant. You should, I recommend everyone to read all of them. I was very excited.
Yeah, he was really interesting. Yeah. Guy to talk to as well.
Oh god, yeah.
Very modest.
Yeah.
But yeah. You know, and just very I don't know, like kind of in his own little world in a good way.
He's well able to talk.
Yeah. Not in his own world, but he refers to, you know, living in Sligo, kind of isolated.
Yeah.
And then venturing out into society almost. Yeah. Like kind of like in gathering information and then going back to his shed.
Yeah, that's like just that, you know? That's just the last few years. That's like since his first book, or just before his first book, because before that he lived in, well, Limerick, and that's where he grew up. Then he lived in, I think, Liverpool and Barcelona, San Francisco,
New York as well.
Yeah, he's lived everywhere.
Yeah,
so it's very strange now that he's kind of settled in Sligo, but look, it's working for him.
It is.
So
maybe we should all move to Sligo.
Maybe and get ourselves a little shed, as he describes in the...
It sounds amazing.
It sounds great.
The whole time you're saying that, I was thinking, fuck, I wish I had this shed I could just go and hide in. Yeah.
You kind of do.
Yeah, I kind of do a bit.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't think there's too much we can say about this. I think I just urge everyone to go and listen to it because he's much more interesting than we are.
Yeah. He does say a lot of things that make you go, you know, make you think, and
you
know, even little things like he's talking about the internet, and when he was saying about how you know, he tells himself, okay, the internet is switched on at midday.
Yeah.
To give yourself that time off in the morning. I was thinking, geez, I'm actually going to try that, because you do reach for your phone and you know, fucking check shite on the internet first thing in the morning, and then it's in your head, like you're saying, it's there, you're in, you know,
internet zone.
Internet mode.
Mode. Yeah.
And so basically what I'm saying is, nobody should go near headstuff.org.
Hey! If you have to go on the internet, Headstuff is good because the quality is so great.
Yeah, but not before 12.
Okay, fine.
That's the new rule.
Well, I suppose that means that we can stay in bed until 12 as well then, because we have nothing to be doing.
That kind of implies that we're in the same bed. I'm just going to point out, we live in different towns.
Wasn't necessarily talking about you, but...
Yeah.
The episode begins with Kevin Barry reading the first page of Beetlebone. He's a phenomenal reader, real theatrical, so it's fascinating to hear him read his own work. We also have a signed hardback copy of Beetlebone to give away, so make sure you listen to the end of the podcast to find out how you might win that. So I won't keep you any longer. This is the Kevin Barry episode of the Head Stuff podcast.
He sets out for the place as an animal might, as though on some fated migration. There is nothing rational about it, nor even entirely sane, and this is the great attraction. He's been travelling, half the night east, and nobody has seen him. If you keep your eyes down, they can't see you. Across the strung-out skies and through the eerie airports, now he sits in the back of the old Mercedes. His brain feels like a city centre, and there is a strange tingling in the bones of his monkey feet. Fuck it, he will deal with it. The road unfurls as a black tongue and laps at the night. There's something monkeyish, isn't there, about his feet? Also, his gums are bleeding, but he won't worry about that now. He'll worry about it in a bit, save one for later. Trees and fields pass by in the grainy night. Monkeys on the fucking brain lately, as a matter of fact. Anxiety. He hears a blue yonderly note from somewhere. Perhaps it's from within.
It's amazing. I've I've seen you reading before. It's people always talk about how good you are at readings. I haven't seen you reading from Beetlebone yet.
Yeah.
Until now, when you're doing John Lennon, when you're doing John
Lennon, I don't
Doyle,
do a Scouser accent.
You don't do it?
No. I can do a Liverpool accent because I lived there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I can do it anyway, but it doesn't really sound like John Lennon. It sounds more like Stephen Gerrard.
Oh.
Or Jamie Carragher, you know. It's kind of all right. It's kind of a Liverpool accent. So it's and John Lennon's actually is quite a posh Liverpool accent. It's South Liverpool. He was from, despite his protestations to be a working class hero, he grew up with his aunt and uncle, and they lived in quite a nice leafy suburb in South Liverpool. So he would have been quite a almost posh Liverpool accent, you
right.
know. So it's he would have been the posher one of the four, actually.
Okay. If such a thing exists.
George and Paul and Ringo would have been from ordinary terrace houses on the way into town,
okay.
whereas he was that bit further out in the leafy suburbs. Very, very strange, though, to live in Liverpool, which was in 04 to 06, I think, and to see things all the time, like seeing Penny Lane written up on buses.
Yeah.
And seen signs for Strawberry Fields
yeah.
and things like that. So it brings it all very much kind of into your immediate surroundings.
I got very excited the first time I was there and I saw those places as well, Strawberry Fields and yeah.
Yeah, geez, they're real, you know.
God, yeah. Well, that's where they got the idea for that.
Yeah. It's weird. I moved to Liverpool. My then girlfriend, now wife, was working there, which is why we moved from, we had been in Edinburgh for 3 years and I loved Edinburgh, really liked living there. And I kind of whinged about Liverpool for 2 years while I was there. I was giving out about it and grousing about it. Because Edinburgh is a very gorgeous, pleasant city. And Liverpool can be rough enough around the edges, you know. But as soon as we left it then, we moved back to Ireland. And as soon as we left it, I really missed it. And I was kind of getting really homesick for it, you know.
Right.
And it's kind of like I'm always... I'm never happy at the time. I'm always happy in retrospect. You know, that was great. As soon as I leave a place. The good old days.
Is
you
that
know?
Why you've lived in so many places?
Yeah, I guess. I've been settled more or less now, though, since we came back in 2006.
Right.
We've been more or less in County Sligo most of the time since then. I mean, I'm always up and down here and things like that. But
I have the books.
So no, that was the first time I owned a property.
Right.
So that was the first time I kind of had a steady kind of base, which has been great, you know. I mean, it's not the joys of life all year round in a swamp in County Sligo, but it's I like it. Like it can be fucking evil in the winter, you know.
Yeah.
This winter was just November 1st. It started raining, and not just misty, ethereal west of Ireland rain. It started fucking apocalyptic cliff falling, and for 10 weeks solid. It rained heavily every day, and we just went. I always bolt in January, go off to Spain and stuff, and go. And we were in Berlin for a while just to get out, you know. But it's great because it's cheap to live in an old house in South County Sligo, and that's the main thing for writers. The best writing advice is to keep your overheads low.
Yeah,
you can have good years and bad years. You know, it's very unpredictable what way money will be. So it's to have a cheap base is. It's a great thing. It means you can go off on little jaunts and trips, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be very hard. No, it's weird. I know, by the way, I ramble a lot, as you notice. You don't really have to ask any questions.
Yeah, that's
just
fine.
Go on for the day. But it's
makes our job easier.
What you notice, the traditional thing for writers, I guess, was that you'd go and live in a big city. You know, you'd live in Paris or New York or London or something and be a writer.
Yeah.
But it's very hard now because you just won't be able to afford to, you know. Writers can't afford to live in New York anymore. Or London, you know, it's just physically not possible. Berlin is maybe one of the last big cities where you could do it. Even Dublin would be very hard, you know.
Yeah.
So expensive now to pay rent and all that.
Yeah.
So it's my big theory is that the smaller places are the future for artists and writers and creative people, you know.
And then
the overheads are low, and you can make a go of it.
And do you need that? Do you need to be able to live in different places, or even live where you are now in Sligo, and then be able to travel to other places in order to maybe get ideas for
I think it's very important to get out of the house, like you know. I have a very nice shed in Sligo behind the house. It used to be a stable. It's an old Garda station, previously an RIC barracks, so it was the stable, and then it was our coal shed. But I won a prize and we got a man to do it up for us. it's very cozy now, but I have to get out of the shed as well. I can't just sit there comfortably all the time, or I'll end up writing a novel about a fella in a shed. Inevitably, you know, and put a fucking gun to me if you hear that I'm at that. So, and I notice actually with all the all the short stories and the novels or scripts or whatever I'm writing, it nearly always the original idea is a place. Almost always it's right, the place that gives the inspiration for something.
Yeah, that, I wanted to ask you about that actually, because even like the titles of your books is, you know, kingdoms, city, island, like away it's always place.
Yeah, and it's weird, when the first one came out, when the first book of stories came out there, the kingdoms, I started doing readings and events, and people ask, you know, where do the stories come from? And I developed this very eloquent kind of answer about found dialogue and Hiberno-English and all this stuff, and I'd be trotting this out, you know. And I was listening to myself on there, I was going, this is actually complete bollocks. Like, this is completely made up. Because it struck me, it's actually always the place, you know. I could pick any one of the stories and tell you where I was when the notion come. And it's usually, very often it's getting out my bike. I take my bike out around the west of Ireland in the summer and go cycling for a few days. I learned to drive a couple of years ago at the age of 44. I'm still on a provisional license, but I'm not Russian. But that's been great. It's really opened up my radius, you know. Yeah. Drifting around, like going Roscommon, I'll go, oh, I can go up there, up these old boreens, you know, and see what you find. And it's great freedom. Like I'm really enjoying it. I'm planning on mounting some expeditions into Donegal this summer, because it's kind of the last bit of the Atlantic coast. I don't know at all, you know.
It's going to be a Donegal novel then.
Inevitably, I would say. I'll have to write in a Donegal accent for a while.
Yeah.
A lovely, soft, mellifluous Donegal accent.
Do you have more ideas than you can keep up with?
I start loads of stories and they don't get anywhere, you know. You can tell fairly quickly if something has a bit of real momentum under it. But I would say, you know, I probably try about a dozen short stories a year, but only two or three will ever really get any kind of a proper finish on them.
Right.
Or will ever be shown to anyone or sent outside the door of the house, you know.
Yeah.
I think at some level it is kind of very important as any kind of writer or artist or musician to try and finish everything you start. Everything you drag up onto the desk, try and finish it. Even if you know it's kind of bad or crap while you're doing it, because I think it's very important to have a kind of an ethic, you know, a kind of a professional ethic about it.
Yeah.
Would you do that even if you were, you know, halfway in and you decided this isn't great?
Yeah, but I'd plough on, because you never know what'll show up in the last stretch of something that might really transform the whole thing.
Right.
And it might be that last bit is really the first bit of your story or something, do you know what I mean?
You learn by finishing.
I think that you only earn the good ones if you finish all the bad ones, because you learn the ancient thing. You learn so much from your mistakes and from your failures as you go along.
That's true.
But it's I do try and finish everything to some degree, the story. So it means there are hundreds of things lying around that I completely forget about. I pick up stuff. I just can't remember right that at all. You know? And even though, you know, I was 37 when my first book came out, and there's only four books so far, and there's been a couple of plays and short films and stuff, but I write reams, you know. I write loads of stuff.
But that's four books in 8 years.
That's not that's bad now. It's been more or less every couple of years since I got going. But I have a habit, generally a life, of being a late starter, you know. I was in 44 learning to drive.
Yeah.
I learned to cycle a bike with about 15. No joke. Like. I learned to swim when I was 29.
Wow.
But I'm a flyer then when I get going, you know.
Yeah.
it's kind of delayed process of getting there.
And as well as the four books, there has, as you say, been other things. There's been literary essays and radio plays, and you're talking about doing a play as well.
I love writing. I've written 2.5 plays in the last 6 months, and it'll be three soon, I think.
Okay.
I'm very, very drawn to it. Yeah, I've done a couple of bits in theatre. I had a play in Cork in 2008, one in Galway in 2010. Just small things, but I've really enjoyed doing them, you know. Kind of, again, because it gets you out of the house and you get to talk to people for a while, and you get to have colleagues and workmates for a while, which is a great thing, you know, because it's my background is in my 20s. I was working as a freelance journalist, which is, you know, you're not getting rich, but it's sociable, you know, you're getting out and about and you're doing things. Whereas writing the books, it's you and four walls and And you're kind of staring, you know, and going slowly nuts a lot of the time. So it's, I've really enjoyed trying the plays, and hopefully now, I think inside the next year there'll be one or two things definitely happening, and I'll keep you posted where and when. But I remember I was talking to my namesake Sebastian Barry once, mm-hmm. who's of course a playwright as well as a novelist, and he was saying about plays, you know, that the good ones come in about a week or two, you know, they tend to come in a bit of a flash and you get them down very quickly, and that seems to me the way. You can think about them for years and have the vague notion kind of planted there, but they tend to, the actual writing tends to be a very quick process, you know.
That's the same same for you with novels as well, though, isn't it? You say about your immersive 10 to 12 weeks.
I was hoping so after the first one, because I wrote City of Bond very quick, inside a year. I wrote the first draft in 10 weeks or 11 weeks, then it's been about another 6 months, and then another couple of months, so it was very quick, and I was convinced Beetlebone would be even quicker, but it was it ended up taking years, really, 4 years or something. Not constantly 4 years on the desk, but coming and going from it for 4 years. Just because it was very difficult, because of the nature of it, was that it was an iconic person, a real person. And I started it off in this very kind of happy mood, thinking this is a fucking marvellous idea. How come nobody thought of doing this before? And inside about 3 weeks, looking down at the pages, going, oh, Jesus, this is very hard. Because you're giving yourself an immediate huge disadvantage, because every reader is going to open the book with a preconception of what he should sound like. And this is what I want him to sound like, almost. So it meant an awful lot of work to and lots of useless drafts and reams to get anything like a voice for him that I was happy with, you know.
Yeah.
It took a long while. But I wouldn't particularly like to spend 4 years with the one novel on a desk again. It's a long time, you know, and it's and you need a lot of patience. And the thing with novels as well is that if you spend 4 years on one, you're a different person by the time you finish it than you were when you started. And that makes it weirdly hard to keep a consistent tone or note going through it. Kind of worked okay for Beetlebone, because it's meant to be kind of mad. You know, it is a guy kind of cracking up. So it's meant to be kind of emotionally all over the fucking shop. But
did you get to a point in it when you're doing that thing where you're thinking, this is,
am
one
I
of the
gone
bad
mad?
Things, or this is one of the bad things. I'm not going to. I'll finish this because that's the craft.
I was kind of doing endless drafts of it, and I was kind of, each one was giving me just enough to go, I might. That line there could almost sound like him. That's enough to keep on going for a while, you know. It was kind of when I gave him a sidekick, really, when his driver became this character Cornelius, who becomes his kind of spiritual guide around the west of Ireland. When he stepped forward and started mouting, and when they started talking, it kind of came to life for me.
So he wasn't in the original few drafts?
Well, he was, but he was just a driver, not doing very much, the odd comment. And then suddenly he moved forward, and it sort of, once I made John part of a double act, essentially.
Yeah.
It was.
Well, it seems like one of the most important parts of the novel.
Oh, completely
the friendship,
so, yeah. And that didn't happen for about at least the first year or so, really, you know.
Okay.
I was going through all sorts of versions and reverberations with it, and doing it in the first person and the second person, the third person, and the past tense and the present tense, and eventually I just kind of threw them all in, you know, and so we'll try it all and see how it goes. But it was a really lovely book to get out of the house
and
to go goodbye, you know. It was nice to get it off the desk. I realised that it was clearing up a huge amount of headspace when I got it off the desk, you know, because you are kind of, you do have to necessarily become quite obsessive about it with novels, you know.
And you're always in it then.
You kind of are, you know, you're kind of distracted a lot of the time, and I find the last kind of year on it, and it was the same the last few months on City of Bohan, very intense, really. And you don't switch off from it much at all, you know, and probably not great fun to live with. And I'm not sleeping well, because it'll start racing around my brain at night. So it's in some ways the short stories and the plays are more attractive propositions, because they're as mad and intense, but they're quicker. You can go in and out quicker. And like with a short story, I think it's almost like writing a song or something, probably. You know, it can be a very quick 2 or 3 day process.
It's interesting. The whole process seems to be very similar to what musicians, you know, say about writing music. Like, say, an album being written that has 10 songs, the artist could have written 100 songs for that 10 songs, the same as you're saying, that you've oceans and oceans of things that you've done just to get this one piece.
And I was cleaning out the shed after I'd finished it, and I was kind of doing a rough count. Boxes of shit like were coming out, you know, the various traps. And it's like, it's a short novel. It's about 50,000 words or something, which is pretty short. But I was doing a rough count and I probably wrote 350,000-400,000 words.
Wow.
To get it down to that. And that seems like a very uneconomical working process. But that's increasingly the way I go. I like to do the kind of drafts very quickly and not kind of worry too much about the sentences or the English or the language or anything. Just so I want to get loads of stuff that I can then start cutting at, because I like editing and I like cutting.
How do you find that if you're saying getting from 300,000 down to 50?
Yeah, I just like the process. I feel useful when I'm editing, you know.
Right.
Like when you have the scalpel almost in your hand and you're really cutting away at it. Or to use a fairly kind of well-worn analogy, it's like, you know, a sculptor has a block of stone and has to chip away at it to find a shape in there, you know. And it's amazing how much you can cut and still the thing is kind of standing up. Because you realise when you're doing those early drafts, so much of what you're putting down is scaffolding, you know, just to try and make the thing kind of stand up on the page. And then the fun bit is actually when you're going, well, if I take that away, oh, it's still standing. Oh, take that. Oh, you know, and keeping it balanced and keeping it, you know. But yeah, it is an all-consuming kind of process. But I do kind of try and remind myself that I'm not kind of down a coal mine either. Laying roads, you know what I mean? And it's very nice that I can. I mean, one of the reasons I live in County Sligo is because it means I can just write, you know.
Mm.
If I was living in a city, just to go back to what we were talking about, I'd have to teach or something as well, probably, to pay the bills.
Yeah.
So I'm in a very fortunate position that I can just go off to my shed and light the fire and put on the music and work away for the day or for the few hours that I do in there in the morning. So it's so you try and remember that it's quite a privileged position to be in as well, to be able to do that with your days.
It sounds like a lovely shed.
It's a very nice shed. It's a cosy shed. I have a great couch in it that I collapse onto for a while in the afternoons. I have a great old couch that came from Amsterdam. It was a 50s couch from Amsterdam. Oh, so you can imagine what must have gone on in that couch. But yeah, it's nice. It's weird. Like, I think writing, or being any kind of an artist or any kind of a musician, it's you have to keep a very careful balance where you kind of have to dip in and out of the world all the time, you know. You have to have your kind of seclusion and your isolated kind of disciplined periods of time where you're working, you know, where you're going hard at it. But also you have to, you know, you have to be involved with people in the world and listening to people and going around the place and getting into trouble, you know, as well. You have to give yourself material also. So, but it's a balance, you know.
Mm. Talking about editing there, when you're going doing your own books, what about, say, Town and Country or Winter Pages? Mm. When you're editing other people's work, do you find that you like to take chunks out, or is it a different type of editing altogether?
Oh no, you have to be far more sensitive with other people's stuff than your own, you know. It's fine to upset yourself. But it's I think you have to kind of just try and like with a lot of the stuff that I would commission for Town and Country are from or for Winter Pages, it would be from people I know to be really good writers and stuff, so I'm not going to be making much in the line of suggestions about their sentences or anything like that. But it's maybe sometimes with very young writers or debut writers who you're given a kind of a showcase to, you might make suggestions. It's just kind of careful reading, really, and see what the writer is trying to do, and see what they're trying to do with the style on the page. But it's fun. It's nice to to break out of your own world and look at the way other people operate and deal with problems on the page all the time, and it can really free you up, you know. So no, it's something I really enjoy, actually, and it doesn't feel like work when you're editing right. other people's stuff, okay. you know, which is just being a reader, really, you know. Okay. And it's a really kind of concentrated form of reading that you're doing, so it's good for you as a writer, I think, as well.
And when you're doing editing or writing short stories, plays, essays, screenplays, whatever it is it all just writing to you, or are they different? Do you prefer to do one type? Or?
Yeah, like I've been writing loads of scripts for films over the last few years, and there's been a few short films made now. Mm. Lots of them based on short stories originally. There's a couple of features that I think have a very good chance.
A friend of mine worked on one of them, actually.
Oh, really? What one was that?
Wifey Redux.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was out in Dunleary or something last summer.
I haven't seen it yet.
Ernestine and Kit is another one that I just saw recently. It's very good. But the scripts feel very different from writing prose fiction, actually. You feel like you're at about kind of 70% of capacity, you know? You're not using all your muscles.
Right.
And it can be quite dull work in some ways, because there's a lot of kind of shifting characters around from A to B and just moving furniture on the page, kind of a thing, and a lot of it can feel kind of slow and tedious. But the upside is, you know, you'll get a draft of a script done very quickly, maybe in a few weeks
right.
or in a couple of months. So it's they're very different. I do think it's like there's two reasons for writers to try their hands at lots of things. I think one is pragmatic, as in very few writers now make a living purely as a novelist or purely as a, God help us, as a short story writer or something, you know. But I also think it can really improve you in one area of your work to try other things, to write in other areas, you know. Writing screenplays tells you an awful lot about basic storytelling structure, and very often actually about how little you need on the page to keep the story moving along, you know. I remember doing the first script for a short film, and I thought I had it pared to the bone, you know, and then seen it in rough cuts and gone, Jesus, I could have cut way, way more of this, you know. Yeah. It's amazing. I had this kind of project that didn't quite come to fruition. It might yet, with a Spanish artist called Ali Mercado, a friend of mine in Kilkenny, who's a great graphic illustrator. We were trying to get a graphic novel together, and learned an awful lot about storytelling just from watching the way Ali works right. in pictures, you know, frame by frame by frame, and thinking how much or how little you need of a kind of a skeleton frame to keep a story going. Try lots of things. I regret not spending time writing plays when I was younger, because I think there's so much to learn with that craft. It would have been very useful to have a few years warming up to it, you know. I think if anyone who's listening is writing, it's important to think that they don't get caught up in the notion of the novel. And as young writers often do, I have to write the great novel, you know. Think, you know, it's far easier to get a play put on in a room over a pub than it is to get a book out. It's hard to get a novel out.
Yeah.
And if you get a play put on over the room in a pub, and you make your friends the actors and you make yourself the director, you will learn so much about your work in front of an audience of three people and a dog, and two of them are your aunts, kind of thing. But you learn so much, and it's something I wish I'd done younger, actually. I think when you have to, it's in the few experiences I've had when you have to sit in a room watching a piece of yours with people, you know, it's terrifying, but you learn a vast amount about everything in the work, about the comedy in it, about everything else, about lines you're convinced are going to get laughs that just go completely.
And the opposite.
Jesus. And I'm always amazed by that, doing readings actually as well of the short stories, the lines that get laughs. In Ireland especially, people are very dark. Stuff that they laugh at. I remember the Handsome family saying that actually years ago in my journalism freelance days, interviewing the Handsome family. Great. Are they based in New Mexico, I think? But they write very kind of gothical new country songs about suicides and about crazy stuff. And remember interviewing the girl, Rennie, the songwriter, and she was saying, you know, we tour around the world with this stuff and people look at it and nod their heads somberly, and we come to Ireland and everybody laughs all the way through the show, you know. So it's laughter in the dark is the phrase for Irish people and their humour, you know.
Yeah. And have you an interest then in directing? Would you like to direct one of your own plays?
I don't know, really. They're very mixed feelings about that. I think it can be hard for playwrights to separate themselves enough from the work. I think I'd rather, the experience I've had is to go in very, the first few days of rehearsals and then the last day or two of rehearsals and never looked in.
Right.
I think that maybe that's almost a better way of going at it, you know, to leave someone else bring it. Yeah, you have to, it's very different from the books, where with the books you have, you know, your own stamp on it completely, whereas when you write a play, you have to leave your ego at the door when you're going into the rehearsals, you know, because you have to, it's going to be transformed by actors and made into a very different kind of thing. And it can be an amazing experience and an awful one, I'm sure. But it's, I can't imagine I'd have the, I think I'd go nuts if I was trying to direct something, actually. I don't think I'd be able to switch off at all from it, you know. I'd go very mad very quickly.
Is that
wouldn't be a good idea.
Is it difficult for you? I read a quote, I don't know if it's correct or not, but you're talking about your ego and how your ego is a big... what is it, like a monster of an ego or something right, bursting out or something?
I'm sure I did.
So you won't be happy until you're accepting a Nobel Prize for literature or something.
Funny, I made this kind of offhand remark. A questionnaire in a magazine years ago.
Oh, right.
And it was like, are you ambitious? I said, oh, I won't be happy until I'm getting the Nobel, you know?
Okay, so
and bizarrely, any time I've been out of the country, at kind of, when a book has come out in Holland or in France or Spain or something, a few have come out now in foreign languages, the first thing they asked me, Mr. Barry, you've stated very clearly your desire to win the Nobel Prize. So you realise that the irony bit doesn't transfer over. But no, you have to be. But I mean, seriously, you have to be ambitious, you know. If you weren't ambitious as a writer, you wouldn't do it, really. You know, and it is a real statement of ego to say, I have something to say and people should drop everything and start reading it, you know.
So
you have to have a measure of it that I guess you have to try and keep in check without, so you don't turn into a megalomaniac. But no, ambition is very, very important fuel for trying to make anything.
But how does that ambition represent itself? Is it just to be continuing to make a living from writing books?
Oh, I think so. I think that's
the prizes
the only
don't come into
kind
it as such.
Yeah,
though, is it?
I mean, I think the only real, and I try to view it always as the only real definition of success is that you can keep going, you know, and you can keep doing it and keep getting away with it and not having to go out and work as well at doing something else that you don't want to be doing all day. So it's, I mean, I've been lucky. The first book of stories came out in 2007. And since then, pretty much, I haven't had to work on anything else. You know, I've just managed to keep going by getting prizes here and there and sort of bursary awards early on and just then selling a few books. I've managed to keep going. And that's definitely something that I'm you know, very quietly proud of, I suppose, that I can kind of make my living by the pen, you know.
Well, it's any artist's ultimate goal, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's hard now, and it's again that interesting thing. It's you have to be canny about it, you know, and you have to be cute, and you have to decide where you're going to base yourself as a fundamental thing, and also how you're going to operate. But it's and of course, for decisions you make about your life generally are going to feed into the work itself, of course, you know. The fact that I'm living in a County Sligo swamp is getting more and more into the work every day.
Right.
And the stories are getting closer and closer to the swamp every day, and starting to circle around it. So where you place yourself in the world is going to influence everything that comes out. And if I think about writers I like, you know, and their work, how it was, how it changed, was dictated over the years, you know, it's very often got to do with where they put themselves in the work, you know. I mean, like an Irish writer like John McGahern, say, who you know, was from a country background in Leitrim, then was in Dublin teaching in the 60s and 70s. But it was actually a decision he made late-ish on in his late 40s to move back to the countryside, gave us two or three late novels set there that were probably the foundation of his great and deserved reputation, you know. And very often it's where you decide to put yourself in the world is going to really affect the work and can make or break it in lots of ways. So it's a very important decision if you're trying to start out as any kind of an artist, is where am I going to go?
Yeah.
You know? You know, you might decide, just been spent some time in Berlin, and there's loads of young artists and writers now who've moved to Berlin because it's the last affordable metropolis, really.
Yeah.
But the problem then is, do you have the same experience as all the other young writers and artists in Berlin, and do you all end up writing the same novel?
Mm.
Like, you talk now about the Brooklyn novel that everybody is writing in Brooklyn, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of finding your own patch is difficult, you know, but it's... I would have been amazed if you'd said to me kind of 15 years ago, you're going to end up living on the border of Sligo or Roscommon, you know, at a garage station.
Yeah.
You know,
you'd been
bananas, like, but it was, but it's weird. I'm happy enough out there, even though it's very hard to get used to living in the countryside. I never had. And it's a very strange experience when you suddenly, living beyond streetlights.
Yeah.
Do you miss anything about, you know?
I'm kind of in towns or cities often enough that I'm not completely cut off.
Yeah.
But it's I do find if I'm kind of more than about 3 weeks consecutively in the swamp, I get a bit kind of stir crazy, all right, and have to go out somewhere for a few days. Most of the time I like it. Winter is hard. The last stretch of winter, January, February into March, is hard, and it's a good time not to be there if you can manage it.
Yeah.
But no, I really like it. It's really. Like, the amazing thing about Ireland is how quiet it gets when you go inland, when you go off the coast. Mm-hmm. You know, I go out on the bike around Loch Arrow, is the lake we live by, on a midweek morning for an hour or two. You know, and you can go for 2 hours and not pass a car. And not see a sinner,
yeah.
See a few sheep. And it's just so quiet and so almost eerily quiet, you know. And it's, it feels like a very good place to be. And I feel very, definitely feels like home by now, you know. It's strange. You can't predict where you're going to end up and what it's going to do to the work and all that. And I'd be very interested to see how it feeds into the work now over the next while as well.
Just a quick one there. It's interesting you said about the translations into French and German. It's like, just thinking about the language of City of Bohan. How does that work in French?
God only knows.
Yeah.
I understand that the German one was very good, actually, from what I gather.
And do you know the translator?
I met him. He came over for a while, and he was up in Anna McCarrick in the Writers' Centre. And he's a really good translator, and he had done a very good version of Clockwork Orange before.
Okay.
So I had a feeling, that's my man for sure on this one. Hadn't heard very much about the French one, so I don't know what that was like.
Right.
I know there was two translators. One guy started, did a couple of chapters and disappeared.
Yeah.
And they had to give it to someone else. But it's, it varies. You haven't a clue, like, you know.
Yeah, that's,
you're really having a clue what they're like.
Is there more to it? It might sound like a silly question, but is there more to it than literally translating the book, or is there other things that need to be done?
But I think very often in something like the City of Bohan one, it's written in a kind of a very strong
dialect. You're making up words all over the place.
I'm making up words a lot, and there's an awful lot of kind of Limerick slang and Cork slang essentially used in it as well, fiends and bjors and all this kind of stuff. I don't know, it's weird. Some translators contact you a lot and ask you loads of questions, and some you just don't hear a word from. Beetlebone and some of the stories have been translated into Dutch, and I've had loads of back and forth conversation with the translator there, a guy called Aki, and I can tell he's very good because he's asking the right questions, you know, all the way through. But yeah, it's a strange one to imagine what these little worlds would be like translated, you know.
Is there any of those books, like the German fella had translated from German into English, so that you can read his translation of a German book?
Yeah, it'd be interesting, but no, not that I can recall. But it's it's kind of, there's an amount of kind of luck involved with it, I think, you know.
Yeah.
You can land yourself with the right translator, true luck, and you look at the books they've done before, I guess, really,
yeah,
and see is it even broadly
right
in the
Clockwork Orange seems like a good
Clockwork Orange seemed like a very good kind of marker,
yeah,
for this one, you know. So it seemed like a good idea.
Fucker Burke might be my favourite character name
Fucker
ever.
Burke.
how important is naming characters? Like, how long do you spend thinking about names of characters?
They either come incredibly quickly and you have them in a flash, or it takes forever.
Right.
And you know, I have characters, I'm sure, in Swords that I'm not quite happy with their with their names. I have a few story titles that I don't like as well, actually.
But okay.
The names tend to have to come. If you like them, they come.
Right, okay.
It's very difficult, you know, naming characters.
Do you ever use real names?
Other than John Lennon.
And very rarely use...
Yeah, like people you went to school with or anything like that.
No, but maybe I guess you kind of see it in retrospect. You see some name you've used and you go, oh, that was a landlord or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And very use. I've only once ever directly based a character, well, apart from something like John Lennon, but a character on someone I knew personally in the first book of stories, and a guy who had moved to San Francisco years ago. So I thought, no way will he spot this. And it was just, he's a small character, and he put it just a very precise physical description of him, and he was on to me about 3 days after the book came out. An email, hadn't heard from him in 15 years. Oh, thanks very much for that, Kevin. He was a guy from Derry, so it'll always get back to him. But it's I don't know, it's you are very scared when your first book is about to come out, because you're obviously going to use stuff from family life and all that, and you think, oh, jeez, they're going to kill me, you know.
Has there ever been any awkward Christmas dinners?
No, the strange thing is actually that they don't mind, in my experience, and they spot it all, like, straight away where you got stuff from, but they don't mind so much, and they start feeding you bits.
Yeah.
Do you ever hear about such and such kind of thing? But I've heard scare stories from writers as well. Falling out with close relations and not talking for years and things. Yeah, so it can go either way, you know.
Someone, I've been lucky. Who was it? Someone had written a full novel and then somebody sued saying that the character was based on this person, and the author was claiming it wasn't. But if you don't know the story yet, then you might not know it. But he wasn't allowed to release a novel. It was a finished novel. I thought it was someone like Sebastian Barry or someone.
Right.
You never heard that?
I'm sure these stories are kind of legion, you know, that there's so many of them. I've been lucky so far.
Mm.
I guess often what I write myself tends to, it might look like realism at first, but it tends to drift off from realism very quickly. And goes into kind of strange places, right on the edge of kind of believability, which is kind of where I like to operate often. To try and draw the reader along where they're going, ah, come on, no way, you know. But maybe, just give me a rough go, well, maybe. So with something like City of Bohan, this is kind of, a kind of a mad future version of Limerick or Cork, or a kind of combination of the two, essentially, in a homicidal future populated by teenage hipsters kind of thing. you're asking a lot of the reader, and the only way to bring them along is line by line and sentence by sentence, and convince them with every kind of sentence as you move through the process of it. I very rarely write kind of very direct realism, I'd say. Maybe in the first book of stories, there's more in that line. But I'm inclined to let it drift off out to the edges.
Right. When you're going through your loads and loads of drafts of Beetlebone and you've got your 300,000 words, do you decide that you need to be making an appearance? Or was that always the...
At the centre of the novel Beetlebone, there's essentially a personal essay where I come into it myself and talk about the making of the book. And it kind of came about accidentally, really.
Right.
Because I had notes written all over the place, you know, in different little notebooks and on the backs of envelopes and the backs of beer mats, tapped into the iPhone. And I said one day I must buy a nice new fancy kind of moleskin notebook and gather all my notes in one place. I just kind of started transcribing them from everywhere. And as I did that, I was kind of telling the story straight about John Lennon buying this island and about how I was trying to get out there to have a look at it. And as a very effortless paragraphs started to form. And this was the first time there had been any effortlessness in the whole process of this book, you know. So immediately you have to start paying attention when it's going easily, you know, when it seems natural. And as I started to write that stuff, I kind of very quickly felt like, oh, this is the heart of the book, really. And this has to go bang center of it, you know. And I think it lifts the book. I think it brings it up a little. Because it's a book about a guy trying to make a record, you know, and it's about creative process, really.
Yeah.
It's about trying to make a novel or trying to make anything creatively. And what do you do? And you have to go into your own past and you have to go into your own dark places and you have to use all that material in quite a cold way.
Yeah.
And remove from it, which is what the book is about. And that essay gave me that very directly. And I wrote it very quickly. I wrote it in about a week. and hardly needed to change a word kind of thing. And when it comes that easily, and when it feels that finished on the page, you have to pay attention and go, okay, this kind of has to go in, you know?
Yeah, it's very, like, it is very jarring when you first get to that chapter. Mm. And I was like, what's happening here? It's kind of mad, like, you know, and I was like, what is happening? And then you go back to the start of the book and trying to remember how the book started. And normally that's not a good thing in a novel, for something to really take you out of it. But it works really, really well, because then you get into the essay.
Well, I think what keeps the reader is it's still about getting to an island.
Yeah,
the book is all about getting to an island, and what that might mean in your life, in any kind of sense, metaphorically or kind of in any way. So I thought I would keep the reader if I kept it about trying to get to an island.
I think I was just thinking more about, I mean, obviously that correlation is there. I think I was just thinking more about your confidence as a writer, like, to be kind of brave enough to do something like that, which isn't, you know, it's not a normal thing to do.
It was, and you know what, I thought by that stage in the book, like, I had the kind of double act up and running, and John and Cornelius, and they were kind of rattling around happily enough in their van in County Mayo. Mm. I thought, this is kind of, I'll get away with it.
Yeah.
As this, you know, and it's kind of good fun, but I wanted something to lift it a bit above that. I think the essay kind of does that, really, in a way, because it goes into the heart of it more, and it goes into, and I hope it kind of gets more at what he might have actually been like as a character, by talking about it in a strictly non-fictional way for just a while. And you know, the book does attempt to be a portrait of the artist, I suppose. Had a very difficult time creatively for him in his actual life when he wasn't really making songs, you know, when they weren't coming, what might have been wrong, and the essay was a way into doing that. But it was definitely risky, and there were definitely discussions with editors about where do you put it. You know, they were kind of hinting it might be better to put this as a kind of an afterword at the end of the book, but I thought, no, this is the centerpiece of it, really, and everything has to radiate back and forth from this.
Were you interested then to hear kind of public feedback on it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of readers go with it. Some don't. Some find it very jarring.
Yeah.
But fuck it, you have to take risks with it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I thought as well, about a year and a half into writing this, I started to get a voice from that I thought is kind of convincing. I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds like it could be John Lennon. And at that point I thought, God, I could do the real straight biopic version here. And that would be, you know, a very, you know, good commercial idea to do something like that. But I thought, oh, it has to be nuts, you know?
Yeah.
Because its subject was quite fucking nuts, wild. As an artist, I thought, God, the worst thing I could imagine doing was writing a safe novel about John Lennon. I thought I'd have to take risks with it and push it.
Was it ever a serious consideration to do that? Or
To
go down like a biopic?
No, I kind of, but when I had the voice, I thought you could do it now. You know, you could do the whole sort of proper biographical kind of novel treatment on it. But I was happy that I pulled back from any notion of going in that direction. But it's, you have to be kind of half scaring yourself, I hope, a lot of the time.
Does that ever happen to you where you're writing and you decide, you know, actually this is a better play than it is a novel, or this is a better short story?
I think trying to recognise what the thing is can be half the battle on the desk. Definitely with the first book of stories, there's a couple of pieces in that are little plays, for sure.
Right.
And little short films and stuff, you know. But actually the biggest, I hate to say something like the trick of it with writing, because it's such a hard thing to get any kind of a fix on, but it's knowing what project should be on your desk at a particular time in your life is very important. I think very often the mistake that younger writers or emerging writers make, they're trying to write novels that are years away from being able to write. That's certainly what I was trying to do in my 20s. I think there's a very natural time lag before stuff in your life and in your emotions starts to properly come into your fiction. With me, it takes 10 or 11 years before I'm bitter enough for that stuff to need to come out, you know. So City of Bohan was written around 2009-10, when I was kind of gone out of Cork for about 10 years or so. And it's kind of, it uses very much the feeling of small, demented, actual Irish cities, you know. And Beetlebone, I don't know what it came out of in that kind of directly. But I found very often with short stories that any kind of inciting event in my own life, it'll tend to be 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 years back before it starts to show up. Mm. Like, it's very hard to write a story about, you know, why she left me 6 months ago.
Yeah.
Or what happened last month or last week. You know, it's too soon.
Right.
And a very good trick, actually, is if you're struggling, and if you feel in any way blocked and you want to write something or make something, is try and picture exactly to the month 10 years ago. And what was your big problem? What was the thing that was consuming every hour? And it's probably something that seems tiny in retrospect. But that's probably been sat there long enough now that fermented. You can get material.
Yeah.
Fermenting or composting is a gardening term. All the gases are going to coming in it, you know. So it's, perspective and time. But like, I'd written two and a half, three kind of fail novels that I knew weren't going anywhere before I wrote City of Bohan. But the first morning that was up on the desk, I knew straight away, oh, yeah, this is grand, this will be published. I knew it was, I was ready to write it.
Right.
I'd seen enough kind of gangster films, and I'd read enough graphic novels.
Yeah.
And I'd read enough Anthony Burgess and enough Flann O'Brien to have all those influences ready to use, you know. Whereas it didn't feel like that with previous attempts at novels. It was really a stretch. Whereas, but it is the trick, is to recognise what should be on your desk at any given time. And I found as well, you can't store the idea up for later, you know. When you get, I found this with short stories, if I get an idea for one, I have to kind of drop everything and write it then. You can't put it in the notebook and go back to it in 6 months' time. You have to get it on the fly, you know, while it's current in there.
What's it like when a director picks up and you're not involved, picks up one of your short stories and wants to make a film of it? Are you a film fan? Do you watch a lot of films?
I do, yeah.
I suppose, two-part question. What's your kind of take on modern cinema, and is there a lot of good stuff being made, and how do you feel when a director wants to make a movie of something of yours and you have no kind of further input?
On current cinema, I go a lot. I watch a lot on DVD and Netflix or whatever. But it's my most ferocious period of consuming films and stuff, I'd say, was late teens through to about mid-20s. Well, I was still watching an incredible amount of stuff, and I think it's that kind of age is when really formative influences are going in. And the stuff you like in your late teens and early 20s tends to be your most important stuff always, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of my really favourite things are from films I would have watched around then, things like Paris, Texas and Badlands and kind of all that stuff. Mm. Lots of 70s US things.
Right.
Lots of things like Wings of Desire, Wim Wenders. I don't know, I mean, I see some great stuff now, and you go to the IFI or whatever, you know, or you get the DVD, but it's... I always think it's become so much cheaper to shoot stuff now and to make stuff that there should be way more really good stuff happening than there is, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It obviously feels like we've been through a period where the very best stuff has been in television rather than in film. I have a feeling that's peaked now.
Right.
You know? I think there was a golden era kind of starting with things like The Sopranos and The Wire.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
Going up to kind of Breaking Bad. But since, there's been nothing as dramatically attractive, has there? You know, that you've had to go and see?
Well, I haven't been watching, but I know a lot of people are watching Game of Thrones and House of Cards.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how good they are because I haven't watched them. But
I think they're fine, kind of, you know. Yeah. But I just don't think they're quite at the very...
No.
Top level where it was for a few years.
Connor here is the biggest Sopranos fan on the planet.
I'm a huge Sopranos fan as well, and stole viciously from it for a bit.
Oh, really?
And stole loads from Deadwood, actually. That was another.
You've heard that's good.
I've never actually watched Deadwood.
Oh, Deadwood is great. Deadwood is a really great series. But it's you kind of sense that golden era is kind of gone. As regards my own stuff, I love the idea of making films of them, and you kind of take potluck and off you go. And you know, I've been pretty happy with more or less everything I've seen, just from the awe seeing stuff on the screen.
Yeah,
I've been directly involved with a couple of the short films, as in I've written the scripts for them.
Right.
And that's been great fun. I really like to see actors working.
Yeah,
I'm kind of a frustrated actor myself, and I love to see them have funny lines and have good lines, you know. But it's great again. I think it's such a nice break from book stuff, you know, to go out and see actual people at work on actual things, rather than this kind of tentative scratching things down on the page that you do at home.
I've seen you describe yourself as a frustrated actor before. What do you actually mean by that?
Yeah, I think, when I started doing readings after the first book of stories came out, it quickly became apparent to me, one, that I enjoyed doing it, but also that the stuff worked well aloud, you know, and that people liked hearing it. So it was very natural then to start to write short scripts and short plays and things like that. And to think, and increasingly now I'm very often thinking about actors as I sit down at the desk to write something. I've huge sympathy for actors, especially for stage actors, because it's a tough out life, you know. I mean, they don't get paid very well, and very often they're around the country and saying
grueling schedules as well.
Sending out B&Bs, you know, and they do it because they have to. You know, it's really vocational. They have to do it, and I have great admiration for that, and a great desire to give them good material, you know, and to write for them. I wouldn't have the discipline to be a stage actor. I've done a couple of pieces of my own for radio and stuff, which are one-off performances, and that's great, and I've really enjoyed doing that with RT and things. But it's those actors who go out and do it every night, you know, it's really awe-inspiring. And actually, just to go back into what we were talking about, films and stuff and TV, and maybe it's not a glorious era for film, but I do think there's amazing actors around.
I think there's
some fantastic acting talent out there. I can watch anything with Mark Rylance in it.
He's great, isn't he? Were you delighted when he won the Oscar?
I was, and I thought, in terms of a filmed adaptation of a literary work, Wolf Hall was really sets the standard, you know, the BBC.
I haven't watched that.
Yeah,
Wolf Hall's one of my favourite
books. It's terrific.
The two of them. I love both of them.
Fabulous books, but it just... He gives an amazing central performance as Thomas Cromwell in them. But
I think I won't watch that. I think until I read the third book, and then
and it's interesting. I heard her in an interview, Hilary Mantel, saying she's struggling with it.
Book,
because she can't get him out of her mind.
That's what I was worrying, and I was going to ask you about that actually.
I could see it happening. The actor has completely got into her mind, and he does it brilliantly.
Well, that's a credit to Mark Rylance, but I was wondering about that because you were talking off mic beforehand about City of Bohan 2, which I'm incredibly excited about. But I'm also aware that there's supposed to be a film, or somebody has bought the rights anyway.
Oh, it's City of Bohan. Parallel Productions, and it has been a very good Irish company for since the book came out. The latest I heard was that it was more, they were trying to develop it as a TV product. So we live in hope.
How do you think that might affect you then, writing a sequel? Well,
writing a sequel hopefully helps the whole process along. You know, it gives more material out there. But it was, it was really interesting to see Hilary Mantel talk about that, about seeing Mark Rylance as her character has kind of hampered her in some way for the third book that's supposed to be coming. But actually, Wolf Hall, talking about that, it was a really, it was a book I was thinking a lot about writing. Beetlebone in a weird way, because she uses the present tense brilliantly in it. You know, it's all told and it's a historical story told in the present tense, and it just works brilliantly. Where she described it as putting a camera behind the eyes of the main character and just going like that for it, you know. And it was very, very helpful to me writing Beetlebone as well. But what I love about her as well is she's funny, you know. They're actually very funny books. And all my favourite literature or fiction is at some level funny, is at some level comedy. She's a tremendous writer.
Who are the Irish writers that you do? You look up to any Irish writers? Or I heard you talk before about how you don't see yourself as an Irish writer, or you don't do Irish writing as such.
I was going to do some Irish writing. I was just away there for I was away for about a month in Berlin, and I brought a few books, and I brought the late Dermot Healy's novel, A Goat Song, and blown away by it again. Hadn't read it since the 90s when it came out. And he was a great writer. Sadly, died the other year. But fabulous book. I think in the second half of the 20th century, Irish writers were really struggling with these two kind of contrary influences of Joyce and Beckett that were there, you know.
Mm.
And it was like Catholic prose and Protestant prose, you know. Stained glass windows, everything goes down on the page. Or an austere little Protestant chapel where everything is removed and pared away and peeled back. And it was like, which direction do you take, you know? And I always liked to think that there was a third way, which is the kind of Flann O'Brien approach where you kind of take the piss out of everything and make fun of it. I don't know, as I must say, though, as I get a bit older and as I mature into handsome middle age that I am, I do like to read Beckett stuff more than I used to when I was when I was trying it in my 20s.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, grand. But you get more out of it. And he's very, been reading the letters of Samuel Beckett, and they're very impressive. He was a very good friend to people. He seemed like a very decent man, a very kind person. But also his whole bleakness, misery stuff. You can see there's an amount of it as kind of shtick. You know, it's his routine.
Yeah.
Oh, God, you know. I have cysts again. I was always a great one for cysts. You know, this kind of stuff. And you can see he's actually making fun of it a lot of the time. But definitely, yeah, I kind of like the really pared back world of that stuff more so as a now than I did when I was younger. But I don't know. I mean, most importantly to me, I'd say when I was trying to write first in a serious way in my 20s were probably more American writers and American Jews specifically. I was convinced I was the next great American Jewish novelist down in Cork with my ginger hair. I was reading Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and stuff like that and wanting to write like that because it had such vitality sentence by sentence and page by page.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that probably the mistake that I made as an emerging writer in my 20s was I didn't read broadly enough. And I think you should read loads of different types of things and let it all mangle together and maybe give you your own style out of that. And I would tend to be obsessed with one writer for a while and then you end up copying, you know, and you end up making kind of pastiche versions of a Saul Bellow novel or a James Ellroy book or something like that. But I definitely think for any writer of my age and chronology, television and film and music and comic books are just as important as literary influences.
Yeah.
And the stuff, to go back again, the stuff that goes in your late teens and early 20s, you know, tends to be the formative kind of stuff. So when I was in my late teens, early 20s, I was into David Lynch films and Twin Peaks and I was into Pixies records.
Right.
And going to Sir Henry's down in Cork and taking loads of yolks and doing loads of acid. And so these are formative things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
All your experience comes out of that. Everything you're going to bring to the books, I think, ultimately comes out of those late teens, early 20s moments. And the kind of scary thing now is if I was in my late teens or early 20s now, would I be reading loads of novels? Would I be, you know, watching French films, like, and I was I just worry now about.
You'd be playing Candy Crush or something.
Would you just be on the fucking internet all day?
Yeah.
Essentially, you know what I mean. And I don't know, you know, how that's going to affect our storytelling genes, really.
Yeah.
You know, it definitely makes you more impatient.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And you have to. I mean, it's definitely going to change the way we tell stories. You know what I mean?
And the stories that are going to be told, like, you know,
you
do worry about that generation, this current.
I not just that generation. I worry about myself. I'm online as much as anyone.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you take a classic old Russian novel now, right?
Yeah.
A War and Peace effort, or a Dostoevsky, or anyone, and what you find is you have to give those books about 80, 90, 100 pages before you get into them, right? And readers were patient like that. They would give the novelist 80, 90 pages and go along, and suddenly they were hooked and into it. But it would take. They're not going to give you that now. And that really changes the way you write a novel. So you know, you have to get them now in 5 pages.
Yeah.
Or they'll fuck it across the room and they'll go playing Candy Crush.
Yeah.
Or they'll look at Jumping Cats on the internet. You know what I mean? I think it's also the thing, you see, the internet is a very egotistical place to be. It's all about you when you're online. It's your reaction to things, and here's what I'm doing and here's where I'm going, and it's all about me. Then you have to pick up a novel or something and you're passive suddenly. Hang on, where do I get my say? Where you know, I don't get the comment, you know. I don't get the
comments at the end of the book,
you know. So it's kind of I mean, I don't worry about storytelling as a thing, because we need it as humans, because our lives are disaster generally and shapeless, messy fucking things, and we need to put shape in them, and that's why we tell stories about them and put narratives on them. But the way we do that is going to change. The Japanese read on their phones all the time. We don't. The Japanese like read fiction on their phones.
You know?
And there's a whole thing there now where there's this kind of short formish fiction where, like, very short, like 80 page novels can be read on their phones.
And then the other thing, of course,
I must say, as a reader myself, I'm increasingly drawn to, I love to see a short novel. I love to see a 180 page or think, oh yeah, a couple of hours now, you know, I'll get down.
That's true. I mean, well, that,
but sometimes, but then you go in something like those Hilary Mantel books you talk about, and I didn't go at them for ages actually, because I saw the first few pages are this list of characters, and there's five pages. Oh, I'm not going to be able for that. This, my brain is too addled. But when you go into them, you go, oh, this is what novels are like. You're kind of reminded, oh, Jesus, this is amazing.
Yeah,
it completely lifts you out of your world and puts you down in a mode of transport. I always say, oh, it takes you from one world and puts you into another. But it's I wrote an essay about internet addiction for the Dublin Review here. And it's only actually often when you start writing it down, you realise how much these things are occupying your thoughts, you know. And what it does to us as an awful word, but consumers of stories is very interesting, I think. Because there's no doubt that we're much more impatient from being online. Mm-hmm. And it's the one thing actually I know I can't do in the mornings, or I won't write. I can't go online.
Yeah,
you know, if I start, and I have to do all sorts of things now, like locking the internet dongle into the car and crazy stuff. Like that.
Taking the handbrake off, and pushing it down the road.
It doesn't reach the shed. Wi-Fi doesn't reach the shed. It's a fucking great thing. You know? So I have to do what I call the walk of shame through the yard and into the house and upstairs to check my email. But it's if you go online first thing in the morning, if the iPhone is reached for on the bedside table and you start checking stuff, you're immediately into online mode, which is very flitty. It's very impatient. It can be great fun.
It's very hard not to do it as well.
Very hard.
Your alarm is on your phone. You turn it off and then it's just like, oh, what's going on?
You have to buy an alarm clock. I keep saying it to writing students. Yeah. Buy an alarm clock. Because if, you know, what I'm pretty good now at convincing myself of this thing. I've just tried to convince myself in my head, actually, the internet starts at 12 o'clock every day. It gets turned on up in the sky by the sky god at 12 o'clock. It's not there until 12 o'clock. And even if you can keep that 2 or 3 hours in the morning clear, it's a great thing, you know. There's definitely a reaction. I've noticed, I was talking a couple of years ago even now to a crowd in NCAD, young art students, very cool crowd, early 20s art students. And I noticed the big thing with them was, oh no, we're not on Facebook anymore.
We're not on Twitter anymore.
Well, you know, it's kind of a reaction. So it's vinyl records and it's kind of, you know. But I don't know. It's I'm sure there are some sort of 19-year-old geniuses out there who would figure out how to use this technology in a storytelling way. But I don't know whether it's... Like, one of the things definitely is we still... As we're doing a podcast, we might as well talk about them a little bit, but I still think people like to hear stories.
Yeah.
And love the oral quality. So things like Serial and all these things that have become such phenomena.
Yeah.
You know, it's because it's the one thing that can still slow our little mad, crazy moving brains down is the human voice.
Yeah.
When we hear a story well told, it's still got, oh, okay. And that'll calm us down a bit. And
I was
going
to say, do you ever, like when you were...
I do the audiobooks myself. Yeah, and I'm very, very into them. And they don't sell much audiobooks. You know what I mean? They're not a huge thing. People,
I listen to audiobooks. I'd say I go through a book a week.
I think they're growing. I think they're definitely growing.
Because you put them on the car. You know, if you're
they're great
on
things,
your way to
like,
work and you're a bit stressed or whatever, you can just stick it on.
I think they're very variable in quality.
Depends who's reading it. Them and how to produce them.
I've done ones for Bohan and for Beetlebone, and I made a point that I had to do it myself. I wasn't leaving anyone
do a
fucking Bohan accent, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I did them myself. But it's
when you were reading it there earlier on, I did think, because we had the pleasure of hearing you recite some of the book earlier, I thought, God, you must do some of these audiobooks.
Yeah, but I definitely think that's one of the things that can slow us down still, you know, the voice. And maybe that there's some sort of I don't know, future and some sort of fictional version of a podcast or something like that. I don't know what it is, but it's
the Head Stuff podcast.
There you go. I'm on 10% of that if you manage to get it going. But it's, I know it's in some ways, like the just the advantage of to be able to be online as a writer is fantastic, you know. You know, when I was writing Beetlebone, and when I go upstairs in the afternoon and turn on the internet, or when it was turned on by God,
for
the afternoon, and you know, I'd be writing about some derelict hotel out in Achill or something, and I'd be able to summon up loads of stuff about it. That's an amazing thing to be able to do that, you know. And it's brilliant. Loads of people tweet about my books and stories and stuff like that, and word gets spread around. So it's you know, the internet is infinitude.
Yeah.
You know, it contains all things good and bad.
Right.
So it is amazing and it's terrible at the same time.
Do you have a private Twitter account where you can go and have a look at what people are saying? No,
but you know, it's very hard to tell you when a book comes out.
Yeah,
and people are talking. It's very hard not to do the old search.
Yeah,
and of course you quickly go fucking mad because there'll be 90 amazing comments and there'll be one fucker in Offaly or someplace who doesn't like it. And you're like, bastard.
Yeah,
gotta get him. Gotta take his address down.
And it's cycled Offaly. Get that guy.
Cycled Offaly. But it's trying to steer clear of Google and Twitter search is a great idea, but it's all writers look like all have a little peek now and again. I don't know, it's a strange time, you know. I do think like there's so much possible with like we were saying earlier, you know, you can make a really decent quality film on your iPhone now.
Mm-hmm.
So why aren't we all out making films on our iPhones?
Yeah.
You know, I talked to actually the musician Adrian Crowley, who I know a bit. And he's made amazing little documentaries on his iPhone, you know, tour diaries and stuff like this. We've been talking about doing something. But it's, very often I love to read biographies, actually, of filmmakers and stuff. And you read about them trying to make films in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. And God, it took so much money and so much equipment and so many connections were needed. And it was so hard to do it. And you think now you have it in your pocket, you know. You have technology they couldn't dream about. Doing really good quality stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I think, oh, Jesus, you know, we should be using that way more. And I guess people are, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there is some... I mean, even very, very short things. I don't know if you are aware of Snapchat or something, but
yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's quite reached what it can reach in terms of quality. But there are some very, very funny things.
I saw Brian Eno talking about online culture and technology and stuff, and he's obviously a very, very smart guy, and you always pay attention to what he's saying about something. And he was saying app culture, as he calls it, as a general term for what you can do with technology. He says that's basically where that is now is where silent movies were.
Right,
That's where he sees it. You know, it's like the 20s, it's like the 1920s. And it's
in 100
rapid,
years, you'll have Batman versus Superman. And
rapid, God, you know. Rapid developments will go in all sorts of unexpected directions. But it's, I think the good thing for writers is you realise that behind whatever kind of technology or anything there is, you know, the content is needed.
Yeah.
And the stories are needed.
I feel like, I think I take a more optimistic view of the whole thing, the whole internet. I mean, I know there is this fear that nobody has an attention span anymore and everybody's flicking from one thing to another. But I kind of feel like there's more content now. So people are reading more than they used to. So people before who maybe wouldn't read, now even if they're flitting through, they're reading. And
it's true. I mean, what you're doing on the internet all the time is you're reading.
Yeah. And the people who want to read and want to read novels and want to, you know, get into deeper articles, find them and do read them.
Mm.
So I feel like overall there's actually more reading.
Yeah.
And the people who had the smaller attention span, if you want, are maybe more pronounced now than they were. They have like a platform for people to see them on Twitter or whatever.
Yeah.
But
I think it's a good point. And I saw something that agent guy, famous kind of nasty literary agent, Andrew Wiley, the Jackal, he's called. But he made a very good point. He was saying literary fiction. He said it's always been read by what he called an effete minority. He said it's always been about 5% of the population who's bothered with literary fiction, with sort of Booker Prize books or with James Joyce. It's always been 5%. He said maybe that might go down to 3 or 4%. You know what I mean? But you know, it's never been like everyone was reading Ulysses and now they're on playing video games. So we do get kind of overly dramatic about it. But I do definitely feel it changed you as a writer as well, you know?
Yeah.
I tend to write lots of things that are broken up into very small little sections and chunks now, you know?
But then any piece of technology might change you. I mean, when people used to write with a pen and paper, or before that a quill, and then, you know, later a typewriter or WordPress.
My pal Irish writer Julian Gough has talked about this as like novels are essentially, they come out of Victorian technology, essentially out of printing presses that were there then, and this was the kind of write, you know, a novel would be written in 12 monthly installments in a magazine.
Yeah.
And by the time it was finished and came out in a book, it would be about 200 odd pages. So that's purely down to the technology that was there at the time. And in 200 odd pages is no more a normal length for a novel than 100 pages is, or than 1200 pages is, you know. So it's one of the things actually in that's very evident, I think, is the length of a story doesn't really matter as much as it used to.
Mm.
I mean, I think I've always thought that the novella, a story of about 100 pages, was actually really attractive.
Yeah.
You know, size for a book, because there are some ideas that, you know, they're too much for a short story, but they're not enough to sustain into a 250, 300 page novel.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that the publishing industry just didn't want 100 page books, you know, didn't know what to do with them. But that's kind of changed, you know.
Yeah.
So I would predict we're going to have an era where there'd be kind of 80, 90, 100 page books coming out more and more. So, you know, you see it already with things like a great book last year by Max Porter called Grief is the Thing with Feathers.
Yes.
Real strange mishmash of styles and everything. Really, really powerful book. And I was talking to him and he was saying it's about 14 or 15,000 words, you know. It's about 100 pages or something like that. So it's a very interesting idea that. And I sometimes think now people want to give to a book the same time they'll give to like an indie movie or something.
Mm.
2 hours. You know?
Yeah.
If I can get through this in 2 hours, I'll give it to you. Because, you know, the fact is there's loads of amazing stuff out there in every genre and in every form.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There's so much YouTube could occupy you know, the rest of your life with cool stuff to look at and really informative stuff and really interesting stuff. And there's so many good books, so many good records, so much good TV.
There's a lot of stuff out there.
There's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's why sometimes you see an 800 page novel come in and go, oh, fuck. Like, that means there's another 10 things I can't read or something like that. So it's.
Well, I do feel with long. I'm attracted to short novels as well. Not that I only read them, but there is a bit of. If something is that long, it's like, did the writer need to make it that long? Could they maybe have done another draft, you know, another cut? I mean, Wolf Hall is, I suppose.
Yeah.
It needs to be that long, I think.
I generally feel when I read novels, I think all of them could lose 50 pages.
Really?
Almost, you know what I mean? You always feel that, but it's...
It's the reason I don't read fantasy, because I think all of them...
They just go on.
Yeah, I think all of them can be cut more than in half, you know? Yeah. But yeah, I think Wolf Hall is kind of an exception to a rule there, really. I mean, and Beetlebone is...
It's pretty short. Yeah, it goes out over the pages because it's lots of white space.
Yeah.
And actually, a few reviewers and stuff have commented on my technique with white space on the page, seemed very, very impressive. And it's basically because I didn't know how to change the settings on my laptop, right? And this is just the way it was. And the editors actually looked at it and went, yeah, very interesting use of white space. I went, yeah. And I was kind of used to looking at it like this as well. And so that's the way it is. I shouldn't be letting that on.
Yeah. That's going to be the headline now on the podcast. all right, maybe one more question before I let you go, just about the actual your job, I suppose. How much of your job is actually writing as opposed to promo interviews,
Most of the time really is going to the shed in the morning. You know, a book comes out every 2 or 3 years and there's kind of a mad month or something where you're going around doing stuff and odd things here and there. But mostly it's me in the shed.
Right.
And I go in there. I'm pretty disciplined now. You know, I get up and the internet hasn't been turned on by God yet, so I can go down to the shed. And I kind of usually in there by not far after 9-ish, maybe 10. And I'm there till kind of 1 or 2 usually. But I'm not writing for 4 hours.
Yeah.
So, but I'm there and I'm available to it. So if an idea comes, I'll be there. And it's, you know, it's saying that you're going to write fiction or you're going to make music or you're going to paint pictures, it's all stuff that's going to come from your subconscious, really. So what you're doing is you're making an arrangement, you're making a deal with your own subconscious. You're going to go, give me stuff, give me material, and my part of the arrangement is I'll be there and I'll be available to it and I'll show up and I'll be a pro. And I'm pretty good now about going in there, and I go in there 6 or 7 days a week. And if, you know, there's some... What you notice is actually, if I'm in there 6 days a week, there's probably one day where it seems to be going well. most days feel quite slow and sludgy and you don't feel like you've got very much done. But then often after a few of those days, suddenly the hand is kind of moving across the page,
right,
and it feels fairly effortless, you know. But you realise the real writing days are the slow ones. That's when it's all kind of sifting and arranging itself at the back of your mind. And that's when it's kind of getting ready to kind of come out. And there's no shortcut.
And do you handwrite?
You have to go through the slow days, you know.
Do you actually handwrite with pen and paper?
I do a lot of the time on first drafts, yeah. It kind of just slows it down a small bit,
right, yeah,
compared to typing.
Right.
And it's kind of nice to have a kind of a tool making marks, you know, on the page. But it's... You definitely learn fundamentally that there's no kind of shortcut to it. You have to go through the really slow days. And I mean, like, the weird thing is literary talent, it's not rare. There's loads of it around.
Mm.
Lots of people can write great sentences and come up with great characters and come up with great stories. But I think what's more unusual is to have that married to the pragmatic streak that keeps you going into the room every day when you're not in the mood to do it. And makes you show up when you'd rather do anything else, really.
Mm.
Those two combined are quite rare. And I definitely had to teach myself the discipline, you know?
Yeah.
In my 20s, I knew I could write very good sentences and stuff.
Mm.
But I didn't have the discipline, and I had to kind of bait that into myself, really, over the years.
Did journalism help with that?
I think it does, training, actually, at some level, yeah. It shows you... You can always kind of write something,
right,
no matter what kind of condition you're in or what you've been up to the night before. You can always kind of get words down on paper, and it does take some of the kind of preciousness maybe out of it a bit. You don't sit around so much waiting for inspiration. You go in and start doing it, you know. But those slow days have to be gone through, and the kind of dreary days,
yeah,
where it's raining and you're looking out and you're kind of drooling, you know. Yeah, three or four of those will often give you that great day where you get suddenly you have 1,000 words down and you haven't had to think about it.
Okay. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, so thanks a million for coming into us.
Thanks a million, thanks, guys. It was great fun. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
So that was Kevin Barry on the Headstuff podcast. Did you enjoy that, Connor?
I really did.
I did too. He's my new friend.
Yeah, it's like we had just a new little friend there for an hour and a half, and then he left. Come back.
I'm kind of heartbroken. He's talking about writing City of Bohan 2, which is so exciting. City of Bohan.
I'm excited at the fact that he said that he narrates. He did the... narration of
his, he does his own audiobooks. I never listened to his audiobooks, so I must.
I'm definitely getting.
Which one are you going to get?
Recommend which one I should actually get on audio.
If you're not getting shorts, if you're getting one of the novels, I'd say probably get City of Bohan first, but definitely get Beetlebone at some stage.
Okay. City of Bohan it is.
City of Bohan. Okay. But be aware, it's mad, but great.
Oh, it sounds amazing.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and rate and comment on it on iTunes. It really, really makes a huge difference. Just tell us what you think of the podcast. Give us 5 stars. If you're feeling particularly mean, 4 will do. But I prefer 5.
Yeah, 4 is a bit scabby.
Yeah.
Anything below 5 is...
Anything below 5, yeah.
You're a bit of a dick.
There it is. Don't be a dick. So if you're interested in the Headstuff podcast and the Headstuff podcast network, you can join the Headstuff podcast network group on Facebook if you just search for that. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook. Read headstuff.org every day and subscribe to after 12 and subscribe to all of our podcasts. Headstuff.org and the Headstuff podcast network needs your help. If you like what we do and you enjoy our podcasts and want to help us survive and thrive, please consider becoming a patron. You can go to patreon.com/headstuff and pledge as little as $1 a month, which is even less than €1. There are loads of rewards that you can receive based on what you pledge. Another way to support us is to tell more people about the website and podcast. Share our stuff on your social media. Tell your friends. Look out for other podcasts on the Headstuff Podcast Network. I've told you about Fascinated with Grod Farrelly before, but we've launched 2 new podcasts. Juvenalia, hosted by Alan Maguire, and No Encore, hosted by Dave Hanratty. Both of these podcasts charted in the top 10 in their first week. They're really, really good, so please go and subscribe to those 2 and leave a rating and a nice comment. If you'd like to win this beautiful signed hardback copy of Kevin Barry's Beetlebone, you have to do 2 things. First, go to iTunes and leave a comment and a rating, and we know how many comments there are, so we'll know if you're cheating. A comment about the Headstuff podcast, and then go to Twitter or Facebook and tell us that you commented and rated and that you want to win the book. So that's it. Thanks for listening this week. We'll be back with more episodes soon. Thanks. Bye.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.